Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagra Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now is retired United States Army Colonel Pete Newell, the former head of the service's Rapid Equipping Force, who is now the CEO of BMNT. Pete, it's always an honor and pleasure talking to you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's an honor to be here. Thanks.
Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. We recently had one of your co-conspirators on, Steve Blank of Stanford University, the man who co-invented the lean startup methodology, which you guys at BMNT have been preaching for a while, and you facilitated the recent Hacking for Allies event with the Norwegian embassy. Talk to us a little bit, Pete, about Hacking for Allies as part of the whole Hacking for Defense concept and how you guys are trying to use actually a kind of a smaller boutique initiative to actually drive long-term strategic change.
Yeah, I would say that Hacking for Allies is really based on the premise that a large portion of the supply chain for everything that we use in the U.S. defense industry originates outside this country. And anecdotally, I think somebody that says like 70% of the supply chain starts somewhere else. Particularly within NATO, and I would say the Five Eyes companies, the need to be able to look at technologies that are originating in one country and apply them to a problem in another, it's accelerating at an exponential rate. The opportunity to look for common problems that can be fed into different places to provide a better look at different technologies and a better way to actually move the technology forward is something that requires, they call an allied approach to it. The Hacking for Allies is really an offshoot of what I would say. I credit Steve Blank with inventing, version 2.0 of Pete Newell. The application of Steve's lean methodology and what we've learned, teaching Hacking for Defense to the next step, which is as great, you're producing all these ideas out of university classrooms, and there's some promising things, but how do you turn those folks into companies?
Right.
And then the second question is, how do you give those companies the opportunity to work on more diverse things and learn and pivot into a scalable response or a scalable solution that not only answers a military requirement, but also helps them build a legitimate commercial business, which keeps them afloat. And I credit the Norwegians for seeing the need for something like this. So I literally was walking out of someplace I had been speaking with one of the SESs from the Office of Naval Research when one of the attachés from the Norwegian embassy grabbed me and said, we need to talk. And we have tech, we have talent, we have ideas, but it's taking us a year for a Norwegian company and $1 million just to find a pathway into the U.S. market. And we have all these common problems. So it started with a discussion like that. We spent time in it's really attacking for fences, I call it. It is first an answer to a sociology problem, which is how do you build networks of brilliant, energized people around specific issues, help them develop a common language and a common framework for execution, and a common set of metrics that they're grading themselves on that ends with the delivery and deployment of a solution, not just more demos. So we ended up in Norway. And actually, on one hand, I was with guy named Ben Fitzgerald, who came out of CNAS and spent time in the Pentagon, and is now with a venture firm in New York, and And Ben and I were doing the meetings with senior officials across the Norwegian government and innovation ecosystem, while the rest of my team from BM&T and several others were actually running a course for a couple of days on lean methodologies applied to defense issues. So it's just, how does lean startup apply? And how do you use it in the context of Norway? And we got done with that. There was a, that's great from both sides. Let's do it. Let's find a bunch of Norwegian companies and do an assessment and do a down select and then run them through BM&T's H4X Labs, which is the arm of BM&T that is focused on establishing companies as investable entities answering a dual use problem. And it kind of gets to the scale is how do you move past the demo stage and actually into creating investable opportunities that aren't just SBIR grants? They're, no kidding, companies you can do something with.
So the question on all of this, right? I mean, the Biden administration is in its interim national security strategy said, hey, we're going to have to make tough choices. We're going to have to sunset programs. There's a sense, right, that this goes right to the top, that the president himself understands the dire need for change. But at the same time, Pete, you know, you were part of the rapid equipping force. We seem to nibble at the edges, right? There's this sense that that none of this, you know, to put it in Silicon Valley parlance, given that that's a key part of both the mentality, but the audience you bring to the discussion a little bit, is the sense that we're not scaling this. You know, so there is a tendency of looking at events like Hacking for Defense or Hacking for Allies as sort of interesting little boutique things, right? But that the system itself needs to move. How do we move the system itself? Because the whole idea has been, let's inspire a new generation to drive that change in the future through these boutique efforts. But it doesn't appear that that's the case. How do you drive this at a big level to move faster, to move smarter, which it seems like we're still struggling with?
So I would say that, probably 7 years I've been at this and five solid. And incidentally, this month is the fifth anniversary of the launch of Hacking for Defense, both as an academic program and as an internal government entity accelerator program. So oddly enough, the timing was perfect. The first part of it is we are learning about the system at an exponential rate now, because we have scaled Hacking for Defense to, I think there are right now this semester, 34 universities in the United States teaching Hacking for Defense as an academic program, seven more in the UK and one in Australia. There's another university teaching a Hacking for Diplomacy class, another university teaching and Hacking for Homeland Security class focused on critical infrastructure or cybersecurity issues, and one more focused on sustainability. So simply, as we have scaled the methodology of curating problems and then putting them in the hands of brilliant people in a very deliberate manner that helps us pivot on the problems until we truly understand the problem we're solving, and then teaches them how to build pathways by which to actually deliver a solution, not just create a new demo or something. The process of doing that is enabling us to build networks of people who are experts at some particular problem and the technologies around it, both inside and outside the government, and creating the opportunity to actually energize them to do something about it. So going back 5 years, you know, we had one company launch out of Hacking for Defense. It's, you know, I last I saw, they had probably 10 or 15 satellites in orbit. The case, though, is that people with the dollars necessary to scale the companies, both internally to the government and externally to the government, are starting to move the dollars and the contract mechanisms necessary to do that. Now, lesson learned from doing that says, now go back and look internally to the organizations, folks like the Defense Intelligence Agency or the Defense Logistics Agency, and start doing that with their own workforce. and see what you can produce. You know, things that are, you know, intentionally hard about, you know, building the new database for targeting for DIA, or, you know, how do you actually create a 3D parts repository that can go to on-demand printing, or, you know, 6-8 months ago is how do you produce N95 qualified masks rapidly?
Right.
So I go back to the series of experiments that we have built inside H4D, both as an academic program and as an enterprise level accelerator internal organization, is teaching us the language that is common to all. It is teaching us about the data that we need to gather from individual activities, whether it's an accelerator or an H4D class or a hackathon or something else, but what data that they produce that can be turned into an insight that drives somebody's decision. And then as we connect all of those phases of those things and those decisions, we figure out where and when we need to do a better job of producing data that allows the decision to actually follow through with more dollars, more impact, and more people.
You know, one of the things that Pete, is among your strong suits, right, is thinking architecturally about this. And everybody is talking about hard choices. And what they tend to talk about are the hard choices about what programs live and die, as opposed to the hard architectural questions we have to ask ourselves and answer. Your organization at which you excelled was a workaround to the system. And eventually the workaround to the system sometimes doesn't really change the system, and then it just ends up going away. What are the hard architectural questions and decisions that we have to make to constitute the structure to lead to the decisions you're talking about, right? To lead to the outcomes you're talking about?
I think the biggest decision is not what people would think. It is the decision to create a doctrine that supports that parallel system. And I call, you know, Rapid Equipping Force, at least under my leadership, as a parallel system that had a permeable membrane back to the enterprise. I tried not to be an antagonist to them unless they were absolutely so dorked up that I had to be. But my job was to help them do better. And quite frankly, you know, I want to say in the 3 years I was there, we completely flipped the model to focus on curating problems off the battlefield and then accelerating the speed at which we could communicate the problem and use that to gather a diverse crowd of experts, both from inside and outside the government, and then incite them to actually work together to build MVPs and prototypes that we could then turn back to groups of first adopters that we had recruited from the forward edge of the battlefield that would teach us whether we were moving in the right direction or not. That, and I call it an OODA loop, is that loop and the speed at which we could turn it was, quite frankly, the offset that counted. That's what allowed us to get inside the decision cycle with Taliban and the counter-IED fight. The ability to codify that in a doctrine which would drive how you train people, how you promote them, how you assess them for coming in, what position they actually have, and quite frankly, what's the structure and the budget that lies to it. That level of commitment is still missing. We're still trying to do this completely inside the legacy enterprise system that, quite frankly, is beautifully built to do exactly what it does. Unfortunately, that's not good enough anymore. So it's not until we commit to, when I say a doctrine level scale, of saying, what is the structure for innovation at DoD, much less the Army? And the answer was not Army Futures Command, which was another collection of the same bureaucracies under another name. If you look, and I would say, you know, the things that happened to me, if you look at REF, AFWERX, Kessel Run, Army Applications Lab, and look at what happens to the people in them. I retired, and quite frankly, every REF director after me retired as an 06, not because they had to, but because they wanted to do more than the government was going to let them do. The guy who stood up Kessel Run, Enrique Odi, retired. He's in 06 and is now working in Silicon Valley. The entire crew that built AppWorks were all Air Force reservists who, at the end of the three-year tour, were punted. They were told, your three-year tour's up. You got to go do something else now. The guy who stood up Army Application Lab is going to retire this summer. Because there's no place for them to go that allows them to continue to use that experience to run the system. They simply run out of room. And one part of the doctrine is, I can give you the, at the tactical level, the way it plays out. I have my oldest son is a military intelligence company commander at Fort Hood. And having a conversation with him and a young woman who's a military intelligence officer in the 101st Airborne Division. And she is like the deputy innovation officer for the division. And we're having this conversation, and she says, I've been here for 7 years, but like 3 years of my time, I have been doing this type of stuff. And the leadership in 18th Airborne Corps is curating people like that. They're giving them opportunities to do things that are different. They're outside their main MOS. They are giving them experience, and they're using what they learn, and they're actually building a whole culture of innovation. At Fort Hood, where my son is, literally he's had this conversation, and eventually the battalion commander looks at him and says, if you really want to do this innovation stuff, you probably need to get out of the Army and do it from the outside. Because he's a military intelligence officer, and his job is only to do MI-specific things. Those are the only opportunities he has.
Right.
The challenge isn't that you're not allowed to, because clearly 18th Airborne Corps under Eric Carrillo and some other great leaders is doing some brilliant stuff. But the international leadership, there's no leadership that actually says, my mission is to cultivate these type of people, give them experience so that when we need it most, DOD's got access to them. It's all still being done by heroics. And that's the, one thing I would tell you, it's got to change. There has to be a job. There has to be jobs for these people to do.
Thanks so very much for joining us. Tremendous food for thought. It is, I think you hit the nail on the head, right? I mean, it's all about people at the end of the day. And if you're not attracting those people to stay, or you're actively telling them you can change this more from the outside, is problematic, as opposed to the entire ecosystem seeing the innovative promoted to leadership and go, hey, I want to be like that Newell guy. Hey, did you hear Newell got promoted? And he's driving change, and he's building more change-minded people around him. I think that short of doing that, it's really going to be a very, very tough, very, very tough to drive the kind of change that we're talking about here. But I admire you, man, for you doing what you did when you were in uniform and continuing to drive the conversation from outside. Thanks very much, Pete.
Thanks, Marco, for donating the time to my soapbox.
Well, you will always have an open mic night. So if you ever wanted to be like, I got a bone to pick, or I got a point to make, Pete, you're always welcome on. It's always a pleasure having you on, and it's always a pleasure talking to you. Thanks. Thanks again.
Yeah, thanks so much.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.